Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of October 7th, 2011. $5 a month to use your debit card. You're a little upset, right?
Checking has never technically been free. Banks don't give away services for free.
But they did, at least for a few years.
Now we're seeing it kind of go back to that status quo of most banks are either going to get you to meet certain conditions to get free checking, or they're going to be charging you a fee.
Then how about some advice on how to break up with your bank? And a tough but important story.
Most women who are in a domestic violence situation have been controlled. And the biggest control that the abuser has is financial.
Plus, if you couldn't get a ticket to last weekend's Financial Bloggers Conference, don't worry, we did.
We all know we need to keep a budget. We know that you think I shouldn't spend money on lattes, which, by the way, I think is nonsense. There's so much more than just start early so you can get this compound interest. And I think, as a blogosphere, that's my one challenge.
Those stories and more coming up on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media.
Show Marketplace Money how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/marketplacemoney.
We have been hearing for months that banks would have to find new sources of revenue now that financial reform measures are kicking in. And it's happening. Just this past week, several announced new fees. You don't like it? Neither does President Barack Obama.
People have been using financial regulation as an excuse to charge consumers more, right? I mean, basically, the argument they've made is, well, you know what? This hidden fee was prohibited, and so we'll find another fee to make up for it. Now, they have that right, but it's not a good practice. It's not necessarily fair to consumers.
And they do have that right. Banking is a business. So why do we think we should get their services for free? Sally Herships has more.
We are so used to free checking. But actually, it hasn't been around all that long. Klaus Bell works for Bankrate.com. He says just over a decade ago, only one out of every eight checking accounts was without monthly charges. But by 2 years ago, three out of every four were free.
That's a big change, but a fairly recent one. And now we're seeing it kind of go back to that status quo of most banks are either going to get you to meet certain conditions to get free checking, or they're going to be charging you a fee.
Bank of America says it's going to start charging customers $5 a month to use their debit cards. Wells Fargo says it will also begin trying out a new debit card fee for $3. And Citibank announced changes to checking accounts, which could see customers paying new fees beginning in December. Bell says for bank accounts that do have fees, the average cost has nearly doubled over the last year to $4 and change. But let's back up a minute. Is free checking really free?
Checking has never technically been free. Banks don't give away services for free.
Mitchell Peterson is chair of the finance department at Kellogg School of Management. He says there are two ways we typically pay our banks. The first falls under the category of oops.
Most of us never plan to bounce a check. Most of us never plan to violate that low balance. And it's, I plan to be good at following directions, and then I don't.
To understand the other way we pay, Peterson says, look at all the bank branches out there and ask, why did the banks build so many?
One of the reasons was it was a way to harvest deposits, which were seen as a cheap form of financing.
We put our money in the bank, and the bank pays us a relatively low interest rate. Then it goes out and lends at a higher rate. But when the bank lowers our interest rate to make more money on its loans, most people don't perceive that as a charge.
So instead of paying $5 a month, we receive lower interest.
And these days, whatever interest bank accounts earn is lower than inflation. That's another charge. Jeremy Tabakman teaches business at Wharton. He says many people don't register this cost because of what's called money illusion.
Money illusion refers to the typical inattention to differences between real rates and nominal rates.
The nominal interest rate is what you get. The real rate is what you get when you subtract inflation. If you're not keeping up with inflation, you're paying the bank. The new fees announced by the banks are just more transparent charges. They've come in the wake of new regulations reducing overdraft fees and the amount banks can charge merchants for purchases made with plastic. Citibank plans to charge its basic checking customers $10 a month. unless they maintain a minimum balance of $1,500 or make one direct deposit and pay one bill online each month.
So we've spent the last several months talking to customers who bank with us already, as well as to prospects who bank with other companies. And really the focus of our conversations with them was, what do you value the most in banking?
That's Steve Trautner, head of banking products for U.S. Consumer Banking at Citibank.
And what we heard clearly from customers over and over again was, make it very simple for me, give me flexible choices, and give me worry-free pricing so that I know what I'm going to pay for the services that I get. And if it's important for me to not pay service fees, do I have clear options that allow me to do that?
So Citibank opted for monthly account fees instead of charging for online bill pay, debit card purchases, or lining up for a teller. But plenty of customers are already voicing their anger at the flurry of new bank charges. Adam Vida was using a Bank of America ATM in Manhattan. He says he kind of understands that banks have to make up for lost revenue.
I still cannot help feeling that if I actually took a look at those balance sheets, the banks are still making good amounts of money at my expense.
Vida says he has accounts at three different banks, one of which the day before informed him that it was raising his minimum balance for free checking by $10,000. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace Money.
So what would you do if your bank started charging for something that had been free?
I haven't seen them yet, but I heard that the bank fees are going to hit my account shortly. It's just unfair.
Not sure if my bank's putting it on. If they do start putting it on, it would definitely be a game changer.
We got a notice in the mail that we were going to be starting to have bank fees if we don't maintain a $15,000 balance. It's somewhat crazy that you have to pay to use your own money.
I started looking around at the other banks, and they all do this, so this is like pissing me off.
Well, we do have choices, lots of them, including dumping your bank. Norma Garcia of Consumers Union is here to tell us the best way to do that. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right, for folks wanting to move their money to switch banks, it is not as easy as just yanking all your money out of your account.
No, it isn't. It actually has to be a thoughtful process. You want to make sure that you do it in a systematic way so that you avoid any headaches along the line.
All right. Well, let's talk about what the first step would be then.
Sure. So the first thing we ask you to do is to open a bank account with a new bank with a small deposit. And then you make a list of all your automatic payments and deposits that are scheduled to go in, and you make sure that you communicate that information to your new bank, and you make sure that if you have direct deposit, you ask your employer to reroute your paychecks to your new bank account.
And so the main reason for the caution here is that if you have some of those automatic bills, auto deposit, it's going to take you probably 2 to 3 months to get everything situated where it needs to be. So you want some money in the old account and some money in the new account.
Yes, that's absolutely right. You don't want to close your old account right away. You want to make sure that you've given your new account a trial run with all of your automatic deposits and automatic debits. And once you're sure that everything is working properly and that all of your debits have cleared, then you can consider closing your old account.
And if you are one of those people who doesn't use any of those automated services, could you potentially just take your money out of a bank and put it in a different one?
You could, but if it's a checking account, chances are you've got some money coming out of that. You might have some outstanding checks that haven't cleared yet. And in that case, you certainly want to make sure that you have left a reserve in your old account and you make sure that everything's cleared before you close out your old account.
Any rules for how long you should wait before you completely clear out of your old bank?
We're suggesting you should wait a month.
A month.
You should always leave a small amount, at least, in your old account before you clear out. And make sure you obtain written confirmation that your account is actually closed.
And why would you need to do that?
Well, it's important in case there's a mistake on the bank's part. Some banks will charge you a fee if you don't maintain a minimum balance in the account. And if you've already gone down as much as possible in anticipation of moving, you might find a nasty surprise of a potential overdraft. You don't want to miss something from your old account that could actually end up in causing you potential fees.
Right. Anything that people typically kind of forget to do when they're switching banks that ends up tripping them up in the future?
Well, a couple of things. Be sure you shop around. There are a lot of banks that have some really good deals and that are eager for new business, and they might offer you the best possible bank account at this time. But shop around and know that it's a bit of a process to properly make the shift from one bank to another. But once you've made up your mind to do so, and if you've done it carefully, it can work to your advantage depending on your personal situation.
And you really should do at least a minimum amount of research before you move your money.
Yes, and Consumers Union has on our website a list of tips that consumers can use to get through the process of switching if that's what they decide to do.
Okay, terrific. Norma Garcia, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
We're about 3 weeks into the Occupy Wall Street protest, which has now spread to cities across the country. The protesters have many messages, but most are upset at big finance and big business. Humorist Christina Wong has some idea why more people aren't joining in.
All week, I've been sipping on Starbucks soy mocha lattes while scouring the web on my iPad 2 for stories about Occupy Wall Street and wondering, why aren't more Americans protesting the way people in other countries turn out to protest against corruption? I Facebooked my roommate Kim from my new MacBook Pro I bought on eBay, asking her why she thinks Americans don't seem to have the collective gall the Egyptians had to overturn the system. And Kim texted me back from across our apartment on her BlackBerry that she thinks it's because the infrastructure of our livelihood depends on corporations that are too big to fail. While we'd have so much to gain from winning the war against corporate corruption, we'd have so much to lose. That idea was overwhelming, but especially a downer. Then I totally remembered. I had a mortgage payment due. So I'm making an online payment via my AT&T DSL connection to Citibank for my home, now worth half its purchase value. And I kept thinking, why can't Americans be like those hippies in the 70s and just run away and protest? I drove my Ford SUV 2 blocks from my home to eat at Subway using a Groupon deal that I was alerted to via Twitter. And I unwound with an ebook on my Amazon Kindle. But the question still plagued me. When will Americans shirk off the corporate trappings of our lives and start a rebel army like they did in Libya? On the way home, I fueled up at Chevron and Google chatted my other roommate, Eddie, asking him, how much worse would it need to get until a majority of Americans take to the streets? Eddie texted me back from his Android 4G saying, corporations have created the technology to keep everyone connected, yet it's such a frenetic tangle of information that people can be kept from ever really communicating to each other. There's a whole revolution that might be happening out there, but we have to unearth ourselves from the meaningless tweets to find it. Whew. Anyhow, I'm going to keep ruminating on why Americans aren't protesting as much as they are in other countries as I make another payment on my monstrous student loan with checks from Bank of America.
Christina Wong is a writer and stand-up comedian here in Los Angeles. This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vicklund, and it is the time of the show when we take your money questions. With me this week is our good friend Liz Weston, personal finance columnist for MSN. Hello.
Hi, Tess.
So before we leave the topic of banks, I wanted to ask you, what happens if we follow some of the demands and just simply let the banks fail?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, I know why people say that. You know, they just want it all to burn down. They're sort of this Puritan thing, and we'll start again.
Right.
Here's the problem. Our economy needs credit to function. And if you do something like let all the banks melt down to the ground, credit will seize up. That's what started to happen, you know, back when the recession got kicked off. Right.
Yeah.
If we actually let the banks go, that would be a drop in the bucket compared to what we'd experience. You have to understand that most companies, for example, borrow money to make their payroll. They don't keep that cash on hand. If that seizes up, they need to start stockpiling cash. They need to reduce their expenses drastically.
Which means the workforce.
Exactly. We would see an unemployment rate like maybe we've never seen.
But I think specifically people are very mad at the big banks. You know, they got a bailout and none of it seems to have trickled down to help customers. At least, you know, on our level as the consumer. And so, you know, why not let a Bank of America go or a Wells Fargo, you know, if they should get in trouble? Because there are plenty of other banks around for people to bank with. So what's the answer there?
Well, all these banks are interrelated. So you don't know when you let one of them go what might happen to the other banks. What we saw with Lehman when they went bankrupt, there was a huge impact. So we don't know what the outcome would be. And just think about it. If you let these big banks go, there would be no more lending. I mean, it would simply stop for a good long time, which means, you know, what's left of the real estate market would disappear. Nobody could get a home loan. You know, nobody could get an auto loan. All those auto workers out of work. You don't want to see a big company get bailed out and then not have any positive impact. I mean, the best thing we can say is it could have been worse.
All right. Well, let's head to the phones. And John is with us from Tulsa, Oklahoma. Hi, John.
Hi.
You happy with your bank?
Yeah, I'm actually very happy with my bank. They all know me by first name and face. So.
Wow, that's unusual, isn't it?
Yeah, they know my voice over the phone, too. I guess I make an impression.
Yeah, well, and apparently you have a lot of questions for them.
Yeah, well, I have multiple accounts, including a business, a few business accounts, and all kinds of other stuff.
Well, so what do you do there in Tulsa?
I run a pooper scooper business.
Excuse me?
I scoop dog poop.
Wow.
For a living?
For a living, yeah.
How do you make a living scooping dog poop?
It's poop 911. It's all over my car and stuff like that. So on my way home about 5 minutes ago, I had a guy pull out his camera phone and take a picture of my car.
There you go.
And if it makes it on Facebook, that's awesome. That's free advertising. So.
Well, so wait a minute. I mean, Liz and I are both dog owners.
Mm-hmm.
We know that part of what comes with dog ownership is you got to own what comes out the back end, right?
Amen.
So well, how is there a business for this?
A lot of my clients are, you know, elderly.
Oh.
They have, you know, companion dogs, but frankly, at a certain point, it's just too much to go out and pick it up as often as they drop it down. And then
and that is quite often.
Yes.
A lot of my customers, not only elderly, are families where they've got other things to worry about. I always tell people, it's like mowing lawns. I just don't own a mower. I own a rake and a bucket.
That's awesome. That is awesome.
I am so impressed that this is actually a business model. I mean, that you can make money off of this.
Oh, I've been doing it for about 3 years. It's not a quick business model.
Yeah.
You have to, I hate to use the phrase, but pay your dues.
Like, you have to pay your doo-doos.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, no.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay. Yep. Enough bathroom humor. Thank you very much.
Comes with the territory.
Okay. Yeah, I suppose this is not unusual for you to have people laughing
so
at what
much.
You do.
No, not at all.
So how can we help you out today?
Well, basically, both my wife and myself went to college. We got our undergrad degrees, and we did not, you know, go to college. I didn't go to become a pooper scooper, and so she's getting ready to go back to school for physical therapy school, and in a couple of years, I'm going to be getting ready to go to medical school.
Oh, wow.
We know that we have some huge student loans on the horizon.
And do you already have undergrad loans?
Well, I have about $10,000 in undergrad loans,
okay.
And then about $5,000 in consumer debt, i.e., you know, credit cards and car payment.
Okay.
Now, we set a goal to get that $8,000 in credit card debt paid off.
Okay.
So then the only debt that we'll have left is the student loans. My question is, from January when we get our car and credit cards paid off through August when she starts back to school, should we focus all of our, you know, intensity that we've been paying down in debt, should I apply that to the $10,000 student loans, or should I build our emergency fund up from about 2 months to 6+ months?
How old are you guys?
I'm 25 and she'll be 24.
And do you have any retirement savings at all?
I have a couple $100 in a Roth IRA and she has about $1,000 from her last job.
Okay.
Well, Liz, so this is really a matter of figuring out what the priority is.
Yeah. I think people get focused on short-term goals a lot of the time, but sometimes, actually most of the time, it makes more sense to start saving for retirement than it does to pay down low-rate federal student loans.
Okay.
I really want to see people in their 20s saving for retirement. It's mm-hmm. the best possible time. And you know when you're in school and not working, you probably won't be able to save. So, you know, I would love to see you both with a Roth IRA, if you could. I also like to see some kind of an emergency fund But again, the emergency fund can't be the top priority. Really, saving for retirement is going to be so expensive. It's going to, you know, basically take you your whole working life to build up an adequate fund.
Yeah, I feel like I've heard you say, like, every $1,000 you put towards it at a younger age, like in your 20s, is worth like $10,000 or something later on.
Oh,
like,
bless you. It's actually even better. When you're in your 30s, every $1,000 you put aside, it's worth about $10,000. When you're in your 20s,
gotcha.
It's worth $20,000.
Wow.
So there's your answer. You're 25 years old, and we want you to think about retirement.
Absolutely.
No, I'm still worried about getting into medical school.
Well, yeah, that's a whole other issue. So, well, good luck, continued luck with your business there in Tulsa. Perhaps we can get you a few more customers there.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your time.
Thanks so much for the call.
Have a good one.
All right, and now, Liz, we are leaving the continent.
Are we?
We are indeed, and we are going to talk with Hans, and he is in Tel Aviv, Israel. Hi there.
Holy cow.
Hi, how's it going?
Very well. How are you today?
I'm doing pretty well.
Have you lived there very long?
Yeah, I've only lived here for slightly over a year.
Okay.
I'm actually American, and I'm just temporarily living in Tel Aviv.
And what are you doing there?
So I'm doing a postdoc at the Weizmann Institute in biomedical engineering.
Well, how has the transition been for you to live in a foreign country?
So actually, the transition was remarkably easy.
Yeah.
Tel Aviv is a very cosmopolitan Western city, and it basically has most of the things that you would enjoy in any big city in the U.S., plus the beach, and you can survive here without a car very easily. And everybody speaks English perfectly, and so, you know, we never really have any problem getting along.
Interesting. Well, what can we help you out with today, if we can, perhaps? I hope it's something that can cross the pond here.
I'm sure you guys can. So I've actually been listening to your podcasts every week since I got here over a year ago.
Yay.
You guys have been preaching the gospel of retirement.
Indeed.
And calling you from the Holy Land, I can tell you at least I'm hearing your gospel.
Well done.
And so my situation is a little bit interesting because I like to tell people I'm in 23rd grade, which means I've basically been living on a student salary for years, but about 3 years ago I opened up a Roth IRA, and
good.
I've been meticulous about putting as much money as I can into it every year and have actually reached the limit, the maximum, for the last 3 years. And so one thing I realized is that putting in $5,000 a year, even though I'm a notch under 30, and putting in $5,000 a year is not going to be enough money in order to fund a retirement. But I realized I wasn't very aware of what the other alternative retirement vehicles are.
Great, great question.
So I was really looking for some advice, you know, something that would be parallel to a Roth IRA or something similar to it that I could put all of my extra money into before I spend it on, you know, anything else that might come along.
This is a great question, and I think, you know, a common one, particularly if you don't have a plan through your employer. What are a couple of the options for Hans to be taking a look at as he tries to save beyond what he's allowed to under the limits of the Roth?
Well, one of the things you can think about if you've maxed out your Roth is a simple old-fashioned brokerage account. And here's the advantage. You control the tax bill. If you invest in stocks or stock funds and hang on to them for a year, you get to take advantage of capital gains rates. So you don't get a tax break putting the money in. Of course, you don't get that with a Roth either. But you are the one controlling the tax bill coming out. And if you're not comfortable picking stocks or stock funds, I'm a really big fan of target date maturity funds. Those are the ones that say, like, retirement fund 2030, if you're planning to retire somewhere near 2030. And so you just pick the date that's closest to when you expect to retire. They do all the heavy lifting for you. Now, are they the ideal way to invest? No, but it's a great way to get started. So for somebody who's young and has many years till retirement, it's a way to get started without having to do a lot of monitoring the stock market.
Okay, great. Thank you guys so much for your help.
You're welcome, and best of luck with your studies, and thanks so much for calling.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.
And finally, we have Suzanne, and she is in Gallatin, Tennessee. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. Did I pronounce that correctly?
It's Gallatin, Tennessee.
Gallatin. Okay. And what do you do there?
I'm a nurse.
Oh, we have a bit of a healthcare trend here,
we do.
I guess,
yes.
On the show. So John was he wants to go to medical school. Hans is doing medical research, and now we have a nurse.
I love it.
I love it, too. That's great. Well, how can we help you out today?
Well, I guess in early August, when the market started going down, mm-hmm. I said, okay, I'm not going to go down this time.
Oh, no.
And I took everything to cash.
Oh, geez. Well, can I ask what sparked you to do that this time? I mean, did you also do it, say, back in March of 2009 when the Dow hit 6,500?
No, I didn't. And that's what sparked me to do it, is because, you know, after we had the big crash in 2008, there would be some pundit come on the TV and say, oh, yes, the day before it fell, I took my mother, my sisters, and I, we all went into cash. And I thought, okay, these people knew.
No, they didn't.
No, they didn't.
No,
they got lucky.
They were market timing.
And so when it happened this time, and I've also heard that it was going to go down again over the next couple of years, again to maybe below 6,000. I said, okay, I'm not riding with it this time.
Oh, well, I don't know who told you that, but unless they can read the future, nobody has any idea what is going to happen with the markets.
Yeah.
Right.
And, you know, I tell you, on this program, we tried to tell folks over and over and over again over the summer to leave it alone. Mm-hmm. You know, the markets go up, the markets go down, and you cannot pay attention to this kind of thing. But, you know, you did what you did, right?
Right.
Do you regret it?
No. I just, you know, and you know that a lot of the market thing is psychology.
Yep.
And so now when I see a day that it goes whoops, down, 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 I go, okay, I'm fine.
But why are you paying attention to it on a daily basis?
Because it's going down.
So you wouldn't pay attention if it was going up.
That's probably the truth.
Oh, boy. Okay. Well, can I ask how old you are?
I'm 63.
Okay. Well, that does make a difference, Liz.
It does.
You know, if you are approaching anywhere near retirement age, you're probably a little more shaken up by what's been going on this year than perhaps someone in a younger generation would. But I'm guessing that your question now is what to do with that money?
Yeah, after a while it sort of sunk in. Hey, you know, I'm not earning anything.
All right, so what are you thinking about doing with this money? Now that I've spent enough time tutting what you did back in August.
Well, what I wanted to ask about was, is this a nice time for some dividend stocks or a dividend fund or something that I will like even if the market goes down?
Well, here's the thing. The dividend stocks typically pay 2 or 3%, but you still have the market volatility. They can still lose value.
Yep.
Right,
so
right.
I would say they definitely would be a part of your portfolio, but I really think the time for do-it-yourself is done. You showed by pulling out that you really can't do this on your own, and it's not. And that's not a knock against you. I think anybody that's within 10 years of retirement should be sitting down with a fee-only financial planner, looking at your whole situation, because it's too easy to make a huge mistake. And it doesn't have to cost a fortune. I mean, there are hourly fee-only planners out there, charge you by the hour, just go through your portfolio. It's an investment of a few hundred bucks. But if it keeps you from making a mistake that will cost you thousands, you know, to me, it's well worth it.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing, turn off the TV.
Yes.
When you hear those pundits, even if it's the radio, sorry, but if you hear people who say they can predict the market, you know, a stopped clock is right twice a day. And these people who pretend that they know are blowing hot air up your skirt.
Okay. What you're talking about is different from what I've done before, because before it's been somebody at one of these companies who made money if I bought their mutual fund.
Yeah, no. Yeah, this would be an independent financial advisor for you, fee only.
Fee only. And don't go with fee. Well, I'm not going to tell you to do one thing or another, but fee-based is not the same thing as fee only. Fee-based means they still accept commissions. Probably the biggest hourly outfit out there is headquartered not far from you in Kansas. It's called the Garrett Planning Network, and they have hourly planners across the country.
Okay.
And they can give you a referral to a fee-only planner.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Thanks so much for the call.
Bye-bye.
Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or shoot us a note. Go to our website. It's marketplace.org and type in Getting Personal in the search box. Liz, thanks so much. It's been great to see you.
My pleasure. Likewise.
And do remember to always talk to your own financial professional, as we've been saying, before you make any big money decisions.
Hands in my pocket, hands in my pocket, hands in my pockets. Because of your giant wallet. Just get rid of it.
Never. It is a part of me.
I'm Liz Weston. I live in Studio City, California. And I'm at the American Public Media Studios in Los Angeles. Let me describe my wallet to you. It's a kind of battered red Coach wallet, and it's very thick because I carry a lot. Personal credit cards and debit cards, and the section that keeps the money also has a bunch of coupons because I'm a huge coupon lover. I think because I'm a mom as well as a personal finance columnist, I know that it's great to save money. And it's not that hard if you have the coupons and the loyalty cards on you, but trying to keep track of them all can be kind of a challenge. Another thing that I have in this wallet, I just noticed, is our room key for our recent trip to Hawaii. And the reason this is significant is not just because I'm a thief and forgot to check out, but it's because we paid for this trip entirely with rewards points. We did have to pay the resort fee and, of course, for food and other things, but the actual hotel was free. I'm a big fan of rewards credit cards. I don't think anybody should carry a credit card balance. I am absolutely against credit card debt, but if you use them correctly, they really can pan out. You know, we put most of our spending through this card, and then we hoard up the points and we use them for vacations. And we've already racked up, again, enough points probably to do it again next year.
This is Marketplace Money from APM American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. At times, it can seem hard enough getting your personal finances under control. But what happens when your whole life is out of control? That's how it feels for many women who are victims of domestic violence. Charlie Herman of WNYC in New York reports on a program to help those women take back some control by becoming financially literate.
Just a few blocks from Yankee Stadium at the Bronx District Attorney's Office, six women are sitting in a makeshift classroom learning about personal finance.
Do you work with your kids now on money?
Ever since I started this program, I actually sit down and so they can understand, like, we have to pay rent, we have to pay light, we have to pay for the car.
It's a once-a-week, 13-week course that covers everything from the basic, how to open a bank account, to the complex, say, investing in the stock market. But what brings these women together is that they're all survivors of domestic violence. Today's class, what should they teach their children about money?
I want her to know about stocks and retirement and all those things, because the earlier you start, the better off you are.
This is Rosa. She asked that we not use her last name. She says her relationship with the father of her three children turned violent in part because of money. She made more than he did in her job as an insurance sales agent. So
he would manipulate me and say, oh, I want this. I want a car. And, you know, because I'm making all this money, I want him to be happy. I don't want problems. You know, well, okay, let's go get a brand new car. And then in the end, I'm the one that got stuck with all the credit card bills, loans, and everything.
That everything else totaled more than $75,000 in debt. In the end, it was a fight over money that pushed her to leave her abuser last year. The argument ended when he threw a bottle and hit her in the side of the face while she was driving.
That was it. I went home and packed up everything.
So part of the reason was a fight over finance.
A fight over finances. Over finances and over the kids.
It's not a surprising story for Claire Stinstrom, Rose's teacher. Stinstrom is a certified financial planner and has been working with victims of domestic violence for nearly 12 years.
Most women who are in a domestic violence situation have been controlled. And the biggest control that the abuser has is financial. It's not always physical. It's usually physical too, but it's always financial.
Recognizing this, New York City's Office of Domestic Violence began offering in 2009 a financial literacy program created by the educational not-for-profit WISE, or Working in Support of Education. David Anderson is a former investment banker who left that world to work at WISE.
What we're trying to do is step into that breach and provide the tools for them to become sound money managers and essentially financially capable human beings.
The instruction is based on a similar program WISE provides to more than 20,000 high school students each year. Experience shows that providing basic financial skills empowers anyone, from teenagers to these women, to make better choices throughout their lives. At the end of the class, the women take an adult version of the test offered to high school students. If they pass, they earn a certified financially literate credential, similar to, say, a certification that you're trained in Microsoft's various programs like PowerPoint. When it came time for the test, five women took it and...
Congratulations, everybody.
And as these women pose for pictures...
Cheese!
Proudly holding their certificates, there's a sense of seeing something more than just a graduation. These women, survivors of domestic abuse, are taking back control over more than just their finances.
So, you know, this class has helped me just remind me what are the important things that I need to focus on, what are the goals that I want to achieve in my life, what's it going to cost for me to achieve these goals, and it also has me thinking about my children. What tools, what skills do I want to give my children that weren't given to me?
The first course was offered in one location to seven women. Now, more than 100 women have enrolled, and next year, the program will be offered in three locations in the city. In New York City, I'm Charlie Herman for Marketplace Money.
I spent last weekend in a suburb of Chicago getting my personal finance geek on. And I mean that in the very best possible way. It was a first ever conference of personal finance bloggers. Now, you might think I was scoping out the competition, but what I was really doing was finally meeting some of the people whose work I've been admiring for years and finding new voices to add to what we do here on the show. So I wanted to introduce you to some of the folks I met and get their take on how their community has grown over the last 4 to 5 years. One of the biggest blogs out there is Get Rich Slowly, started by J.D. Roth, who, though he is too modest to admit it, is pretty much a rock star in this crowd. His blog, like so many of them, started out as a chronicle of his efforts to get out of $35,000 in debt.
For some reason, my story and my voice resonated with people. It turned out I was able to help people and grow an audience at the same time. And here we are almost 6 years later, and things have gone very well.
That's putting it mildly. This is a full-time business for you now. How did that evolve?
Well, I discovered that it was possible to share information about things that I was finding useful, say bank accounts, for example, that my readers might find useful and that advertisers were willing to pay for.
Now, Get Rich Slowly has several staff writers, social media employees, and an advertising unit that Roth keeps at arm's length. You've heard him before on this show, by the way. I asked him how readers know which blogs they can trust.
I believe that there are these time-tested principles that can help people get out of debt and save and build wealth. When I find a site that's trying to bypass that or they're trying to pitch something that seems a little fishy, that's when I don't really trust the site. But at the same time, I think that most people in this space really are trying to help people.
Do we need thousands of personal finance bloggers?
We might not need thousands of personal finance bloggers, but we need more than one. I think it's good that there are many personal finance bloggers because it gives different voices for different readers. Not everyone learns in the same way. You can usually find one that speaks to who you are and that you can use to help get out of whatever financial predicament you're in.
And that's a point I heard over and over at the conference. There were almost 300 bloggers there, and that's just a fraction of them. And what it means is that you can find one that speaks directly to your financial situation. Luke Landis writes under the nom de web of Flexo, and blogging is how he makes his living.
When I started in 2003, there were very few websites that really had this personal spin. And to see this grow to the situation today where we have thousands of people who consider themselves personal finance bloggers, while I'm not surprised by it, I think it's just a wonderful way to communicate that's slightly different than what we get from professional writers, big media. When a reporter is writing an article about personal finance, they have certain standards that they have to hold to their writing. They need to usually be unbiased, present facts in a certain way, without really injecting a lot of their own personal feelings about whatever it is that they're writing about. And with bloggers, you really have the opportunity to get deep into a person's psyche rather than just trying to present the news or to present the latest tax law changes or something like that.
Yeah, that would be me. So perhaps we have two questions. Do we need thousands of personal finance bloggers? And do we need them, plus all of us, in traditional media, radio shows, magazines? Well, MP Dunleavy has worked both sides. She's written for The New York Times and other mainstream news outlets, and now she is editorial director for DailyWorth.com, a personal finance newsletter for women.
If you added up all the readers of everybody here, including all the overlap, how many millions of Americans does that speak to? How many millions of Americans are desperately searching for this kind of advice? What's different right now is that people have had the standard personal finance advice for years, for decades. You know, they've had Susie Orman, they've had David Bach, they've had Dave Ramsey. But what the bloggers offer and what the online community offers that's a little bit different is something that's more down to earth, day to day, based on stories. It speaks to people on a more visceral level.
And if you cruise the personal finance blogosphere, you'll find how true that is. It's all about the stories, not the expertise. Philip Taylor organized the conference. He goes by PT Money and has been blogging since 2007.
Who's the expert? The person who gives high-level generic advice that is sound, or the person who's been through your unique situation and can explain exactly how they went through the process of doing something, getting out of debt, or whatever the particular situation is. The authority relies in the experience, I guess.
I did have fun watching in the run-up to this all of the tips that people had for making this conference itself and attending it frugal.
I wanted to definitely, there's a lot of frugal bloggers out there, so, and they're paying attention to how much the hotel is. Are they going to have to pay for Wi-Fi at the hotel? I'd actually got some tweet complaints about that, but yeah, we paid attention to that, and people found ways to make content out of this weekend.
In fact, we'll have several links to these bloggers' write-ups about the conference on our website, marketplace.org. And finally, some thoughts from Ramit Sethi, who you have also heard on the program before. He's the blockbuster author of I Will Teach You to Be Rich, and he started blogging back in 2004.
To me, the most amazing fact is that about 3 years ago, it would have been almost impossible to quit and go full-time as a personal finance blogger. Now there are so many, it's unbelievable. The undercover secret of the industry is that many bloggers actually have more readers than some of the biggest personal finance magazines. But they don't get the respect they deserve, and I think it's time for a lot of people to pay attention to what these bloggers are doing.
And his main advice to some of the newer bloggers at this conference?
My big thing is, stop writing the same old stuff. We all know we need to keep a budget. We know that you think I shouldn't spend money on lattes, which, by the way, I think is nonsense. There's so much more than just start early so you can get this compound interest. And I think, as a blogosphere, that's my one challenge. Let's think differently, and let's focus on our readers instead of nagging people as to what they should do.
Perhaps advice for beyond the blogger world, wouldn't you agree? And now let's reach into the mailbag to see what you have to say about our fair show. Joining me is John Buckley, who's been filling in as our producer. Hey, John.
Hello, Tess.
Now, I don't know if anybody's going to sense a trend here, but having a foreign accent is not a requirement to be our show producer, I swear.
Tess, what can you mean?
Well, so Deb Clark is a Brit, Patty Hearst is from Ireland, and now we have you.
Well, now you've spotted me. I think I'm going to ask for a refund on all those accent reduction classes I've been taking. But I have held an American passport now for about 10 years.
Oh, right.
So let me kick off with a letter that concerns your recent conversation with my fellow American, the blogger Matt Howey,
yep,
and John Altheimer of SmartCredit.com. Mm-hmm. They'd been having a debate about the validity and worth of credit scores.
Right.
Matt had written a blog voicing his frustration, and John was defending the validity of the FICO score.
And I'm imagining we got a lot of people siding with Matt.
We did.
Yeah.
Tracy Ewing from Indianapolis, Indiana, wrote in. She said that she's in the best financial shape she's ever been in, yet because her available credit is smaller than what's recommended, her credit score is 100 points lower than, as she puts it, when she couldn't afford to eat anything more than ramen noodles and canned tuna.
Yep.
And here's how Ms. Drew Baker from Troy, Michigan, summed it up.
Why is the FICO score such a secret? It's wrong, especially when so much of our lives are tied to it. Home buying, refinancing, getting certain jobs. We can't get the information, but it's our information. And correcting erroneous information is nearly impossible. To quote Matt, It's like a part-time job.
Good point. All right, what else do we have in the mailbag?
Well, a few weeks ago, the big news was the Federal Reserve pushing down long-term interest rates, a move they called Operation Twist.
Oh, yeah. Cue Chubby Checker, please.
Oh, Tess, you don't want to see me dance.
All right, never mind.
Well, Nancy Marshall-Genzer, our reporter, talked to you about it.
Right.
And she said that the move might not have had the impact hoped for because people aren't spending money. Consumer spending is still down.
That's right. If I remember correctly, she told me to go shopping, and I said, okay, I would, but I promised, of course, not to put it on plastic.
That's right, which caused Robert Stern from Phoenix, Arizona, to get stern with you.
A credit card is no better or worse than the person using it. It's a tool. It can be misused, but that doesn't mean the tool itself is bad. Think chainsaw. For most folks, it isn't the credit card that's the problem. You know the Pogo quote, "We have met the enemy, and he is us."
Indeed.
And every Marketplace Money listener knows to listen to the end of each broadcast, because that's when you award your weekly Piggy Award. Linnea Linton from Arden, North Carolina, wrote in. She's not looking for her own prize because she says listening to the show recently was a reward in and of itself.
Hmm. Thank you, Marketplace Money. While we were listening to your show, my 4-year-old son actually fell asleep. So I learned a lot and he got a much-needed nap, something I haven't gotten him to do in about a year, with greatest appreciation.
Okay, a 4-year-old is the only one that I will say, okay, it's all right if they fell asleep during the show. I hope nobody else does. All right, John, thank you so much for your help. Appreciate it.
You're welcome, Tess.
And do keep your comments coming. You can post on our Facebook page, tweet me at Radio Tess, or write to us at marketplace.org. And finally, to this week's Marketplace Money Piggy Award. Our little blue plastic friend is heading to Seattle, though I met his new owner at that blogging conference last weekend. 22-year-old Shelby Burford was there in his role with Biz Kids, a public television series that teaches kids about money and business. But that is not why he gets a pig. Burford graduated from Baylor University in Texas last December. He decided he wanted to live in Seattle, but he did not have a job yet. So here's what happened as he flew to his new city this past New Year's Day.
And so I came on the plane, stocked with a pile of 200 cocktail napkins printed with my resume on them. So I paged the flight attendant and said, hey, I'm, you know, a recent college grad moving to Seattle without a job, and I have my resume here on these cocktail napkins. Do you think there's any way you could use these napkins with beverage service? And so she came back and said, we think we can let you pass them out behind us. So I passed out these resume cocktail napkins to 160 passengers, to much laughter and buzz on the plane, and zero interview requests. So I thought, well, that was great, but I still need a job. And so I emailed the Seattle Times, and 5 days after I moved to Seattle, the front page of the local section was my resume, my contact information, and this story. I woke up that morning to a couple emails at 6 in the morning, and by the end of the day, had more than 100 emails, and ended up doing 27 interviews before signing on with BizKids, which is where I am now. It worked.
It worked. Persistence, people. That is what earned Burford a job and a pig. And we have a photo of that napkin and a link to the Seattle Times article at marketplace.org. That's Marketplace Money for this week. You can friend us and me too on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Radio Tess. Next time.
If I have a choice of investing a lump sum or moving in over 12 months, over 20 years, historically, 70% of the time, I would have ended my 20-year period with more money doing the lump sum than dollar cost averaging in.
The pros and, yes, cons of dollar cost averaging. All right, Marketplace Money is produced by John Buckley with Devin Robbins and Stephen Hoffman. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. I'm Tess Bigland. See you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. This is APM, American Public Media.